What's the first thing I want to do after we have a different president? Take a shower.
Impeachment is about cleansing the office.
Now, mind you, the heretofore document had dry ink on it for at least many fork nights
We signed it a long time ago.
It was a long time ago signed.
I thought you said the law was powerless.
Powerless to help you, not punish you.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 339. I'm Thomas Smith. That's Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm great. You know, we have so much to talk about today. So many good segments. So much that I'm not even going to mention the fact that I have my 27th consecutive cold in a row. Not even going to bring it up. I'm not even going to take the time to even say that I'm not going to bring it up. That's how much I'm not going to talk about yet another cold that I have. From my kids and daycare again. Not even going to say it. We don't have time. Andrew, we don't have time.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't have time. So I'm not talking.
I am sympathetic and, tis the season.
Not going to mention how I'm going to have to be muting constantly this whole time to try to get through it. I'm not even, why would I talk about it? Why would I bring it? Okay. No, we have a great episode for you guys. I cannot wait. We've got a segment that I just now invented called Crackpot Lightning Round, which I think is great. We're going to have a quick Crackpot Lightning Round. And I think these are always fun. The Andrew was wrong is my favorite segment because it's usually you're wrong about something inconsequential, but that's also interesting and has a funny story. So that's always fun. And we've got a lot of impeachment news, don't we? We've got so much to talk about there. Some academics, some Poindexters came on and told us what we all already knew. What I've now dubbed the wild card segment, which we'll see if we get to, whether or not Andrew can get through everything on time, because, you know, Andrew's got a lot to say. He's got a big brain over there, and we all want to reap the benefits. So, wild card segment, fun listener question. We'll see if we get there. But first, are you ready, Andrew, for the quick impromptu segment? You were going to tell us how, I can't talk about Nunes, and I can't talk about Klayman lawsuit against Trayvon Martin because we got a billion emails. And I was like, well, why don't you just, you know, do a quick crackpot lightning round because, you know, you're saying there's not much to talk about anyway because these are terrible lawsuits, but we don't know why. We're not lawyers. We don't know the quick reasons why these are terrible. So crackpot lightning round, go.
Yeah. Okay. Number one, our favorite, I'm losing to an imaginary internet cow, Representative Devin Nunes from your state, has sued CNN for $1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 $350,000. I like the additional $350,000.
Yeah,
that's a nice touch. Alleging defamation by putting out a hit piece that exposes his factual ties to crooked Ukrainian politicians.
Yeah.
This is yet another in the law, right? I mean, the reason I had this on the we can't bother discussing this is because Devin Nunes is an idiot who files frivolous, meritless lawsuits. Someone even asked, and I thought that this question was worth answering, you know, wouldn't that expose him to discovery? Like, you're damn right it would.
Right? Yeah.
Like, because remember, of a public official, the standard for defamation, we've said it, you know, only several hundred times on the show, is the New York Times v. Sullivan actual malice standard. It is then a defense for CNN that the things that they printed about Devin Nunes, the things they said about Devin Nunes were accurate, or, and this is all you need for New York Times standard, is done under ordinary journalistic standards, right? Not done with actual malice, that is, knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth. So in the event that it went forward at all, you would say, okay, well, we're going to serve discovery on you for all of your connections to these Ukrainian prosecutors. And Devin Nunes has no intention of turning over that information. It will not turn over that information. And so in the event that we ever got to the discovery phase, he would refuse to comply with CNN's reasonable discovery requests. And as a result, then the court would either order him to turn it over or order him to or would grant summary judgment in favor of CNN on the defamation counts for, you know, their for Nunes's failure to cooperate in exploring a valid affirmative defense, namely that the story is true. So this is a headline grabbing stunt by somebody who doesn't seem to understand the difference between notoriety and fame. And there you go.
I know this is crackpot lightning round, but I have thoughts. First off,
okay.
Why the majillion, bajillion, kajillion dollars? Like, why not make it a more reasonable? I know he's just a law terrorist, but like, still, if you're like $200,000, you know, $400,000, something where it's like, okay, at least that's in the realm of plausibility if what you were saying was even true. But like, even if you stipulated everything he said was true about, you know, oh, they defamed him, whatever, 400, what did you say? 435 zillion million doubloons?
435 million, yeah. 350,000. And the reason is that count one is the defamation count, and it says, and this is paragraph 42 on page 44, as a direct result of CNN's defamation, plaintiff has suffered presumed damages and actual damages, including but not limited to insult, pain, embarrassment,
there's
humiliation.
There's 100 million right there.
Yeah. Mental suffering, yeah, okay, yeah. Injury another to his reputation, million. Special damages, costs, and other out-of-pocket expenses.
I got news for you. Even if we took Nunes's reputation from the highest it's ever been or will ever be to absolute zero, that's worth like maybe $2,500. I'm just saying. That's about $2,700. I don't know. He's not worth a whole lot is what I'm saying.
Well, Devin G. Nunes believes that he is owed $435 million in compensatory damages. I'm really, really glad you asked this question because, you know, it's in the lightning round. I was going to pass over it, but usually when you get $11 billion as your demand, right? It's like $1 million in compensatory damages,
oh, yeah.
And then 10 billion trillion quadrillion 999. Right, everything else is punitive.
Oh,
nope,
yeah, okay.
This is the reverse. Yeah. This is $435 million in compensatory damages.
That's objectively more than he will or would ever make in his lifetime, but he needs to be compensated that because someone said a mean thing.
It is, and if you are asking, and look, like you don't have to, right? The amount of money that you ask for is called the ad damnum clause. Different states have different rules about whether ultimately the jury is bound by the ad damnum clause. Some states say you can't award more.
That
than
really feels
has
like
asked
a term
for.
I would make up when I'm trying to think of what it was. The ad damnum. Damn it.
Yeah, you don't even have to clown horn it. Yeah. It's, we could say ad damnum till the cows come home. So, you know, lawyers know that your demand is more than you actually expect to get. There is no pleading requirement. There's no uniform pleading requirement that in federal court, which is where this was filed, that requires you at the pleading stage to explain exactly how you've calculated it. But I will tell you, it is good practice to explain.
To like have an Excel spreadsheet, right. Maybe?
Yeah, like, well, you know, to be like, look, you know, we lost, you know, X million in business or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Right? And sometimes it's hard to calculate damages. So, you know, I'm trying to steel man Devin Nunes, nah. And it's a challenge. But oh, and by the way, this is the same like Earthlink lawyer that Nunes uses for all of his frivolous, idiotic lawsuits. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I'm kind of serious about being a law terrorist. If you find a very cheap way to issue completely BS lawsuits, and then you can kind of make it so it'll cost your target orders of magnitude more than it costs you, then like, I mean, it's a decent stunt if you're an evil person. Right?
Yeah. Yes. Two things are at issue here, right? The first is that depending on which state law applies, right? California has very, very robust anti-SLAPP laws. You may have anti-SLAPP laws that kick in because even though this is filed in federal court, you can apply... The federal court is required to apply the substantive state law of where the offense took place. There's a good argument that that took place at all in California, right? Because that's where Devin Nunes is from. That's where he's allegedly suffering this $435 billion worth of damages. If that happens, you know, anybody who's listened to our live show with Carrie and Matthew knows that the California has really robust anti-SLAPP law that will provide for an early dismissal of this lawsuit, and we'll get CNN's legal fees paid. So there is some counterweight, and that's the other half, right? Which is fortunately here, Nunes is suing CNN, and you know CNN can pay a lawyer to you know mm-hmm. the five figures.
They probably
at
have
most
you know a staff attorney,
take.
Right? They can just
yeah. Yeah, that believe me, like that they're look, if CNN's profits are hurting in the fourth quarter, shoot us an email, openarguments@gmail.com, and
no, they're
and
making
I'll
a killing off
to...
of helping Trump get elected, so they're doing well, fine, you know. I want to say this too, did you hear his answer for, because you know it came out the other day that there's phone records tying him to I don't know, the Hamburglar, whoever that guy is, whatever criminal McBadman that Rudy Giuliani was using. And I love it because his answer is so great. It's exactly what you would say if you were totally, completely innocent. They got phone record. Well, that doesn't sound like me, though. Does that sound like... He was on a Fox News interview. He's like, well, do you think I would be a guy who would call that or accept a call from that guy? That doesn't sound like me. If somebody's like, hey, Thomas, did you steal Andrew's bottle of scotch and drink it all in one night? I wouldn't be like, well, that doesn't sound like something I would do. I'd be like, no, I either be no or yes. Like, yes, I proudly did that because, you know, we share scotch. What's a bottle of scotch among friends? Or no, of course I didn't steal his bottle of scotch. Are you crazy? I like the idea that, doesn't sound like a crime I would commit. Weird.
I couldn't agree more.
That's what you say when, like, your wife is like, did you happen to leave the door unlocked or something? You'd be like, no, I don't know.
That doesn't sound like me.
Yeah, I feel like I didn't, but maybe I did. You know, like, that's the kind of thing. Just an ordinary thing you do or don't do every day. Anyway.
This is a delightful, insight, look into the Smith household. Yeah. So
anyway, next on our crackpot lightning round is, by popular demand... the Larry Klayman lawsuit on behalf of, I'm just the whole thing I'm just mad about. Just completely mad. I don't even want to, that a-hole that we all remember for who killed a guy.
Yeah. And so since we went slightly long on the first part of the segment, let's go really, really short here. Larry Klayman is a birther, a racist, an awful human being who uses litigation as stunts and has been multiply disciplined by multiple different courts over the tenure of his legal career. So for filing frivolous lawsuits and for other misconduct in the practice of law. And so it shouldn't be surprising that a racist monster who thrives off of publicity and owning the libs has decided to file a lawsuit that he knows is going to rile everyone up. It has zero merit. It's and it wouldn't surprise me if he were sanctioned.
Yeah, that, cool. Oh, sanction. That'll solve it. That's done a lot of good so far, all the sanctioning he's got.
Well, look, like, you know, you can be, you know, you can have, and again, it depends on where you're admitted, but, you know, you can have your bar license suspended or revoked. And eventually, look, at some point, Larry Klayman's license to practice law is going to be revoked. And we'll cover that in great depth on the show. How about that?
When that happens?
Yeah. When
so what you're saying is, as he goes into his nearing 70th year, then maybe he will face some possible chance of not being able to practice law into his 70s if he does like four more of these horrendous, disturbing lawsuits. Is that what you're saying? Good job, Bar Association or whatever.
If you want to argue for stronger standards making sure Larry Klayman doesn't practice law again, I will sign on to that.
Well, that and the guy in Florida, was it Gates that we were?
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy too. Like, come on. Let's up our standards a little bit, Bar Association.
I agree. And look, like, there is a little bit of the, you know, sort of thin blue line for lawyers kind of activity going on. I've said this here before that, like, the only sure way to make sure you get disbarred is to misuse client funds, right? That is the one thing that across all jurisdictions and across all proceedings will definitely get you disbarred. Other stuff that's way worse, or arguably way worse, you know, doesn't necessarily rise to that level of the other lawyers who are deciding whether to discipline you or not. You want to argue that it's a problem? I don't know that I want to mount a robust defense of how we go about sanctioning and disciplining lawyers. So,
all right. Well, the people,
you should be mad.
The
Martin family will get pro bono, legal assistance. And this is just designed to make you mad. So, you know, I feel a little bit played that we're covering it, but it is important.
Yeah, we're not. It's a crackpot lightning round. We're done with it. We just.
Okay.
But we did have literally 10 billion people emailing asking about it. So we had to at least address it. We had almost as many people as Nunes has damages in his lawsuits.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay, and now that we're done with not even the first segment, let's get to the first segment. Andrew's wrong. What were you wrong about this time?
Oh, boy. So, this exactly follows the pattern that you described. I was completely and inexcusably wrong on who Rod Blagojevich appointed to the Senate to fill out the unexpired term of Barack Obama. In my head, because it makes for such a much better story, I lived through this, but I said, and I think I've said it at least twice, that he appointed Bobby Rush, civil rights activist. Rush is still in Congress, right? He's in the House of Representatives. And in my head, Rush is somebody who is just unimpeachably clean, right? Like, I mean, he's just on both sides of the aisle, like, among people who have respect across the aisle, like, he is universally respected and beloved, and you know, and there are no allegations against him being anything other than a dedicated public servant since time immemorial. Rush was also the only person ever to defeat Barack Obama in an election. Obama ran for Congress in 2000 and Rush defeated him in the primary. And so I think the combination of the narrative plus the fact that Rush defeated Obama meant that I spaced on the person that Blagojevich actually appointed, Roland Burris.
Voldemort. Okay.
Yeah. And Roland Burris makes much worse story. I just got to do a mea culpa. Burris was somebody who suggested himself to Blagojevich to be appointed to the seat, for whom there was he filed an affidavit on January 5th, 2009, that said prior to being called, there was, quote, not any contact between myself or any representatives with Governor Blagojevich or any of his representatives regarding my appointment to the U.S. Senate. Turned out to be totally false.
Mm.
The FBI wiretap of Blagojevich's phone recorded a November 13th phone call in which Burris called up Blagojevich, Rob Blagojevich, Governor Blagojevich's brother.
Crime family, huh?
Yeah. There's some ways in which this analogy is getting stronger, right? And said, hey, I understand that the governor wanted money, and I was, quote, trying to figure out how to deal with this and still be in the consideration for the appointment. I was willing to personally do something, end quote, including offering to give the governor a personal check. But this is taken from the Wikipedia summary, which I think is delightfully dry, quote, he realized, however, that such an action might look like he was trying to buy the seat and wanted to find a way to avoid that perception. So in any event...
I think I want to give you money, but that might be looked at as a bribe. Is there some way I can give you money in a way that doesn't look like a bribe and get the seat? Call me back. Right. Thanks.
Yeah, that's basically what the message was.
No, dude, that's the crime. What are you talking about? No.
Yeah. So there was a dispute over seating him that went all the way up to the Illinois Supreme Court. And in 2009, Roland Burris was named one of the 15 most corrupt members of Congress by our friends over at CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. So, that's a big... I really wanted the story to be... in my head that Blagojevich, you know, appointed a white hat. But scumbags appoint other scumbags, as it looks like. It doesn't change the underlying argument in any way whatsoever, right? Which was Blagojevich appointed Burris, who went to the Senate, right? It was an exercise of his gubernatorial powers. Didn't stop it from being a crime.
Don't know the details, but I wasn't sure if it was going to be one of those things that was like, you know, like with Trump now, where it's once people caught on to this, Blagojevich was like, oh, no, Mother Teresa. I'm appointing Mother Teresa. It was never anybody was going to buy it. It was, you know, like I thought it was going to be one of those where if you change your mind, then it's not a crime. But no, it sounds like it was just crime.
Yeah, all the way down. It sounds like it was just a crime all along the whole way. Yep. So Andrew was wrong on that one.
Well, let's hope Trump remember. He didn't pardon him, right? He was going to, but he, right?
I correct. Can't. Yeah. Trump did not pardon.
Which of our supervillains are still locked away in prisons, or which has Trump let out? I don't remember. I can't. It's hard to keep straight. But nobody is safe. We'll just assume none of us are safe. Okay. Well, I hope you feel bad about how wrong you were.
I do. And, I do. Yeah.
Everybody dogpile Andrew. Hashtag Andrew's wrong. All right. Time for some yodeling at long last. Let's do some yodeling, Brian.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody. So you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just
Russia,
say
Russia, to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please.
Okay. Good. I like the power of calling upon the skies to yodel. So we had some more.
Did you see, by the way, the baby yes. Yoda yodel mashup that Brian did? That is
yes.
just
everybody
genius.
Check it out. I believe in the Facebook yep. group, they should be able to find that. Good reason to be in the Facebook group, by the way.
Yeah.
Search, just go pop into the Facebook and search Yodel Mountain,
type
probably.
Yeah. Baby Yodel. Baby Yodel is what.
Well, I was going to say just for the group to get to search arguments community to get in there and then go through 900,000 posts a day. No, that's a good point. Search Baby Yoda. Or just find Brian. But yeah, that was magnificent. Thank you, Brian. Good work. Hope everybody enjoyed that. And so we had some academics testify. That was great. You know, we got three academics from the Democrats, and then the Republicans found somebody, I guess, to basically just go up there and be like, yeah, no, the sky is blue, everybody. Oh, holy moly, the sky is blue. Is that basically what happened? That's my summary.
Yeah, the academics called by the Democratic representatives uniformly said, hey, what we've been telling you on the show all along, which is, hey, bribery is 18 U.S.C. 201, subsection B2. And by the way, all three of those elements are manifestly met here. The Republicans called upon somebody that it may be familiar to a lot of our listeners, certainly someone I know pretty well, George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. So we're gonna break down his testimony.
Yeah, apparently the Marianne Williamson of legal scholars. Is that I'm feeling bad. Here's the thing. Yes, the president did something that's probably impeachable and all. However, I'm feeling a little bad, a lot of bad vibes these days. There's just stop all the hate. We need to figure out what, so therefore don't impeach because bad vibe. Like that was what I got from it. That
yeah, look, two things that I want to say with respect to that, right? The first is that Turley is a legitimate constitutional law scholar, right? He's not a crackpot. He is not a right-wing Federalist Society hack. So and then his arguments had a bit more. I mean, there certainly was. Maybe we should cover and sort of dispose of the like this would set a bad precedent argument right now, which is and I kind of wish Democrats would take up this line in the Senate of we watched Mitch McConnell steal a Supreme Court seat and then turn around and say if the conditions were exactly the same that he wouldn't. You know, he would appoint a Republican under the exact same conditions under which it was unthinkable to appoint a Democrat. Yeah. So, yeah, we're not too worried about norm setting.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Right?
Also, the idea that, oh, if we don't impeach Trump, then retroactively Republicans would have been totally willing to cooperate with Barack Obama and definitely wouldn't have impeached Bill Clinton. It's just nonsense.
We've
just
got
silly.
The time machine ready. And as soon as you're nicer to Trump, we'll go back in time and do some stuff differently. Is that the argument? Yeah. He also, well, sorry if we're out of order. Did you want to,
out
of
fine,
order. I'm out of order. Do you want to cover Turley now or?
Yeah, let's.
We'll peace.
Cover Turley now, and then we'll wrap up the loose ends.
Okay.
So look, that argument is silly, but as we like to do on the show, I want to steel man what the argument is for the other side, and we want to look and see how we can learn from that, right? So before I steel man, I want to slander. Jonathan Turley.
Slenderman?
So, yeah, absolutely. Please do not sue me for $435 billion. Jonathan Turley's testimony. This is actually not slander because this is 100% true. Quote, in a government of laws, existence of the government will be imperiled if it fails to observe the law scrupulously. Our government is the potent, the omnipresent teacher. For good or ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. Crime is contagious. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. The allegations against the president go to the very heart of the legitimacy of his office and the integrity of the political system. That was Jonathan Turley's testimony in 1998 about Bill Clinton.
Interesting.
Yeah, a little bit interesting. Jonathan Turley is not in most ways he is not discount Alan Dershowitz, and I would be mortified if people started calling him that
that truly only Dershowitz is discount Dershowitz like
no look and by that I mean Alan Dershowitz likes to go on Fox News and say I'm liberal Alan Dershowitz even though he hasn't done anything liberal since Trump has been elected. Jonathan Turley is somebody, and again, steel me on the other side. I would like to be on CNN and MSNBC, right? I would like to be, I'm a public commentator about the law, right? So far be it from me to cast aspersions on somebody who likes to have controversial opinions and likes to make them known in public, right? Good for you, Jonathan Turley. But that's sort of the lens through which you should understand it, right? Like, he enjoys being the kind of gadfly that Alan Dershowitz pretends to be, right? Somebody who is genuinely leftish, right? He's not a howler monkey conservative.
I don't know that he's left. Is he? Well, he said he didn't vote for Trump, right? But I took that to mean he was a conservative, never Trumper. But am I wrong?
No,
on that?
No, I don't think that's fair. I mean, I think it's hard to say. It's hard to pin down, like, on a 0 to 100 scale, right? I don't know if he's a 35 or a 50 or a 65, right?
Okay.
But I know he's not a 90, right?
Yeah, fair.
So, and most of your never Trumper, right? I mean, Bill Kristol is a never Trumper, right? And he's a monster. So, you know, it Jonathan Turley is, he's not somebody you would expect to find in the service of Trump. He is somebody who enjoys having his opinions, his contrarian opinions be out there for public consumption. I think that's fair. I think he would concede to that if he was listening to the show. And, you know, hopefully he is. I know we have a lot of listeners at GW, so maybe they'll pass it on. Can I gig him on another piece of his Clinton testimony?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Because as we're about to break down, his primary argument is, I don't think that the House has sufficiently made its case that the president has committed bribery, right? But in 1998, Jonathan Turley said the following. There is a considerable difference between the House refusing to impeach a president over serious conduct and the Senate refusing to remove a president for such conduct. The House decision establishes the expectations of a people in the conduct of the chief executive and serves as a critical deterrent to presidential misconduct. While the Senate can decide not to remove a president in the interest of the nation for a variety of reasons, the House should not falter in maintaining a bright line for presidential conduct.
How is this guy not a conservative hack? We've got him gunning for the impeachment of Bill Clinton, but defending Trump, the most corrupt piece of crap president we've ever had. What? How is he not a conservative hack? Is this entirely that he wants to just be popular and be on TV?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a much lesser insult to say that you are, you know, attention seeking than to say that you are in bed with Trump. So
right.
That's my effort to defend him.
Okay.
Now, I do want to point out, ultimately, Jonathan Turley's position boils down to, in a constitution that says the president may be removed, quote, for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, end of quote, that the one crime that's listed in that list of three things, bribery, is not an impeachable offense, but that perjury over anything is an impeachable offense. That strikes me as a really, really difficult line to maintain. It's in his opening statement. So, you know, I'll let people decide that for themselves. But I want to walk through his argument, and I want to highlight the parts that are potentially fair. Question mark. And I want to point out how it can be useful in sort of guiding an effective strategy going forward. Right. So I'm going to link his 53-page opening statement in the show notes. And then sort of walk through each of the major segments. Right. Up to page 11 is Turley setting the stage for what I think is a false dichotomy. And here's the argument. The argument is that at British common law, 13th century Saxony, anybody could be impeached for anything, is essentially the argument. And
just peasants going around impeaching each other. Yeah, ah, right. I sold you that bundle of sticks and it was insufficient. Rather, I bought a bundle of sticks. It was insufficient. I impeach you. I doth impeach thee, sir.
Return to me my hay penny at once. Yeah, exactly. And so the idea is, if you that the founding fathers rejected, in place of high crimes and misdemeanors, the word maladministration, right? And the idea being that if you could just impeach the president because you didn't like him, then essentially what you have is a parliamentary system, right? Mm-hmm. You have the president serves at the pleasure of the Congress, but no greater than that, right? That's true. But the false dichotomy that he sets up is, in order to avoid we can impeach anyone for anything, it must mean we can only impeach you for provable crimes of treason, bribery, or crimes that are as bad as treason or bribery. Now, never minding, it's bribery. That conclusion doesn't follow from the premise, right? You can say the founders clearly wanted some level of gut check, right? Some level of, you know, the president has to commit a crime against the office, right? That's what a high crime or misdemeanor means. But we're not going to, like, you know, the U.S. criminal code didn't exist at the time. They were enshrining a general principle, and they were like, yeah. So if the president is committing a crime against the office, we can remove him, but we don't remove him just because we dislike his policies, right? That reasonable middle ground is one that Turley sort of forecloses on by virtue of kind of setting up this this false dichotomy here. On page 12 is where he begins the very worst part of his argument. And this is, again, I'm trying to steel man everything here. Go to page 12, in particular, look at footnote 18. I'm going to read that to you, and then you're not even going to need me to fill in the rest of the story. Right? Here's what Turley says. The problem is that this is an exceptionally narrow impeachment resting on the thinnest possible evidentiary record. During the House Intelligence Committee proceedings, Democratic leaders indicated they wanted to proceed exclusively or primarily on Ukrainian allegations and wanted a vote by the end of December. I previously wrote that the current incomplete record is insufficient to sustain an impeachment case, no cite for that, a view recently voiced by the New York Times and other sources. The source for that is footnote 18, which is editorial, Sondland has implicated the president and his top men, New York Times, November 20th, 2019. And if you're thinking, well, that headline doesn't seem to be support for that piece of evidence, you are dead on. This is grotesque quote mining. Here is word for word. And again, I'm going to link the New York Times article in the show notes as well. Read this for yourself. Here's what the New York Times said. Quote, you know what would help clarify some of these issues? Sworn testimony from the many key players in the scheme who have yet to appear before Congress, and this is the important part that Turley lies about,
yeah,
despite the fact that nearly all of them have been subpoenaed. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Mick Mulvaney, Acting Chief of Staff, Rick Perry, the Energy Secretary, the former National Security Advisor John Bolton, Attorney General William Barr, John Eisenberg, National Security Council lawyer, officials from Office of Management and Budget, and of course, Mr. Giuliani and his bagmen Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. While they're at it, Congress could invite Mr. Trump and Vice President Mike Pence to testify. So, yeah, the answer to virtually everything Turley says in the state of the record of impeachment is the state of the record is that way because we have a president who has instructed duly subpoenaed witnesses not to testify on grounds that do not withhold any sort of constitutional muster. Right. These witnesses are losing left and right in the courts. But, you know, as we've covered on the show, the even moving expeditiously through the courts would make it impossible if, you know, if we waited for courts to rule on all of these witnesses, we'd be into Trump's
second term. It takes years.
Yeah.
Takes years.
Yeah. So I agree. I'd love for the record to be greater. The reason the record isn't greater is because Trump is, and this is something Democrats need to emphasize, in an unprecedented way, withholding witnesses and documents at a level not shared by Bill Clinton, not even shared by Richard Nixon. Yes, Richard Nixon held on to the White House tapes, but Richard Nixon did not demand that all of his aides assert a 100% absolute executive privilege. Richard Nixon did not have complete control over the Department of Justice and an attorney general. I mean, the whole point of the Saturday Night Massacre was that a William Barr level toady was not the attorney general at the time that Nixon ordered the special prosecutor fired. So to not only to not mention that, but to use a New York Times article criticizing the president for exercising and asserting immunity over duly subpoenaed witnesses as support for the proposition that, and again, Turley's words, not mine, a view recently voiced by the New York Times and other sources, end quote, is deceptive at minimum. It's not true.
Yeah, this is driving me crazy because this guy, again, you claim he's not a conservative hack. It seems hard to believe, but okay, he's not. He's certainly willing to like disrupt the course of history and to be the lone academic in the, you know, of the four who's going to say something that Trump supporters use to defend him against impeachment. And, you know, like that's a, imagine having the gall to do that. And then also on the flimsiest of grounds, which is, well, you know, they haven't interviewed everybody. Yeah. You know why we haven't gotten testimony from everybody? Because as you say, Trump has stopped that. So then the message is, well, if you want to impeach somebody, they can't resist. If they resist and stall, I guess we can't do impeachment because you didn't get to talk to everybody. Never mind the fact that from day one, we had everything. From day one, when the call, not even transcripts, not even the full transcript, just the summary, which, or the telcon or whatever it was, we already had it all there. 100% of the information.
The idea, so there was a concept, I think you've addressed it on SIO, and it gets used and sometimes misused, the concept of the heckler's veto, right, that in free speech cases. The idea is you take one person who's disrupting a speech, and then if the standard is, you know, offense to the recipient, then I can block somebody mm-hmm. from speaking simply by being obnoxious, right? And again, used and misused. We don't need to go down all the ways in which it's been appropriated by villains. Turley is suggesting a kind of heckler's veto for impeachment here, and it's clear in the position we just described, right? Which is, well, if the president obstructs things as much as possible, then the record is super thin and you should let it play out in the courts, even though that's going to take years and maybe the president gets reelected. I was going to walk through, because chronologically what he does is compare the Trump impeachment to three historical examples, right? Andrew Johnson, the near Nixon impeachment, and Bill Clinton. But I want to jump ahead to Clinton first, because I think it illustrates this heckler's veto argument. I mean, I smacked my forehead when I read this. This is page 22. Turley says, quote, "With Clinton, there was an act of perjury that even his supporters acknowledged was a felony, leaving them to argue that some felonies, quote, do not rise to the level of an impeachment," end of quote. So think about the implication of that. I mean, honestly, what he's saying is because Democrats were more honest about evaluating the law than Republicans, that means we can impeach Democrats. Because the only argument that is here is, well, look, like some Democrats thought that Bill Clinton had perjured himself. That's right, because Bill Clinton had perjured himself. The fact that we don't have honest Republicans in government is not a feature, right? Like that should not be something that is rewarded. That should not, you know, give rise to the heckler's veto over impeachment. But there it is.
Yeah, and the Constitution doesn't say unless nobody admits it on the other side. Then so impeach for high crimes, misdemeanors, all that. Unless they won't say that they did it, then they're free to go.
Right. In the historical section, because everybody agrees the Andrew Johnson impeachment was a bad thing, he tries to compare the Trump impeachment to the Johnson impeachment by his own terms. It's a silly comparison because he argues, well, they were both kind of similarly fast. Not really. Right. This is page 15 to 16. You can go read it for yourself. Andrew Johnson was impeached over removing Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton. Johnson removed Stanton on February 21st, 1868, and was impeached on February 24th, 3 days later, sent to trial in the Senate on March 4th, which was, what, 11 days after that, right? February is a 28-day month. So that this, just from the beginning of Ukraine, is at 72 days. So I don't think 11 days and almost, you know, 2.5 months is really a great analogy.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's, and again, I'm not, I did no additional historical digging on that. Like, Turley puts those numbers in his own argument. So, you know, I guess it's just up to you. I thought his effort to distinguish Nixon was sort of truly comical. So I wanted to read that because I had an internal bet with myself that I couldn't read this with a straight face. So we'll find out. Quote, "The allegations in Nixon began with a felony crime of burglary and swept to encompass an array of other crimes involving political slush funds, payments of hush money, maintenance of an enemies list, discrediting tax audits of critics, witness intimidation, multiple instances of perjury, and even an alleged kidnapping. Ultimately, there were nearly 70 officials charged and 4 dozen of them found guilty." So, yeah, nothing like the, you know, 30 odd.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just,
nobody's been indicted yet on the, and anywhere in the Trump administration.
Yeah. I mean, you know, his campaign manager was indicted over ties to Ukraine.
Yeah.
But, you know,
this is a joke, and this person should be embarrassed, and the institution he works at should be embarrassed.
Yeah.
This is a joke.
So those are, that's sort of the factual historical record. Then I want to touch briefly on this because I do think we want to refine our argument a little bit, because then he makes the case that the record is insufficient to charge Trump with various crimes. And I'm not going to talk about his obstruction of justice, extortion, but on bribery, again, there's a kernel of a correct point that he makes,
okay,
that
here,
is
here
worth
goes.
Yeah, that is worth emphasizing so we don't get caught in the trap. And that is inciting, as we have on the show, the Bob McDonnell, governor of Virginia, Supreme Court case, right? That threw out 9-0 what seemed like a pretty clear case of bribery on the part of the governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, who he was given, you know, rides in fancy cars, and his wife was given fur coats in exchange for letting shady businessmen have access to the Virginia legislature. The Supreme Court made it clear that section of 18 U.S.C. 201b2, the quid pro quo part, requires the performance of an official act, and just entree is not an official act. And that's true. And so Turley's argument is the postponing cancellation, the refusal to grant an official White House visit to President Zelensky, is more akin to an unofficial act than to an official act. Now, let me say this. You could certainly argue that it's not analogous, right? Like there's a difference between official recognition of a head of state in the White House versus bringing your buddy along to, you know, meetings with legislators, right? But let's suppose that argument is correct. Then what that means is, and this is why you have heard Adam Schiff talk about the 18th century definition of bribery as well, right? And it would mean the following, right? And again, the reason you talk about that is because the impeachment clause says the president may be impeached for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. The founding fathers wrote bribery 150 years before they wrote 18 U.S.C. 201, right? So you have to look at, again, not going all originalist on anyone here, but you have to look at what bribery meant when they wrote it in the Constitution, and they obviously didn't mean something that wouldn't be written for another 150 years. And the way that breaks down is that the exchanging of the demanding of public announcements about investigations into Joe and Hunter Biden in exchange for the White House visit is very clearly 18th century bribery, even if it's not 18 U.S.C. 201 bribery. Withholding duly authorized aid to Ukraine is 18 U.S.C. 201 bribery.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever standard you want to use, 18th century or modern statutory, the president has committed bribery. But it's important to parse and to know the distinctions. I will add, Turley also attempts to use McDonald to say, like, well, this means bribery is interpreted super narrowly. That's not true. That is not what McDonald stands for. McDonald stands for the fact that on the quid pro quo, there we go. On the quid pro quo part, the quo must be an official act, right? But here we have an unambiguous official act, and then we have an ambiguous official act. And so I think it is important that we acknowledge it. And Turley does, right?
Hereby and Turley says, acknowledged.
Yeah. Turley says, well, holding up the aid seems like it probably is an official act. No, it definitely is an official act.
Yeah.
And then he goes into the argument that we've said this is all going to come down to, which is, but you don't have evidence that there's corrupt intent. And, you know, the president can legitimately ask Ukraine about corruption. I know we've covered this a lot, but I want to say a couple of things with respect to this. Right. The first is, in sending out articles of impeachment, right, adjudicating intent is what the jury does. Right. You don't win on a motion to dismiss by saying, well, we don't have ironclad proof of intent in the form of, you know, like brain scan. Right.
Figure that
you
out.
You go to trial, you listen to the witnesses, and you decide on the circumstantial evidence what you think about the person's intent. And here, the evidence we have is as good as any evidence any prosecutor ever gets as to the mind state of a defendant. Right. If there's a statute that says whoever corruptly receives any document, right, and you and I put you on the stand and you say, well, you know, I did receive the document, but it wasn't corrupt. I thought I was perfectly entitled to take it. And then and I say, well, thank you, Mr. Smith. So we're all done here. Right.
Case
and then,
closed.
And then, yeah. And then the government gets up to cross examine you and is like, so, Mr. Smith, isn't it true that upon receiving the document, you opened it and then 14 minutes later deleted the document, removed the hard drive from the computer, threw it to the bottom of a lake,
did
sent
a little
out
evil
emails
dance
to the
and stroked my
right.
Chin.
Yeah, like hiding that would be really, really strong evidence.
Here's a photo of you twirling your mustache, sir.
Yeah.
Damn like, it, you're right.
Efforts to cover up receiving the document are prima facie evidence that you knew you had corrupt intent in receiving the document. And we and prosecutors prove those kinds of cases all the time. And then, you know, with respect to the like, well, he could have sincerely believed that he was asking Ukraine to investigate its corruption. I kind of think I want to try this out on you.
Bill Clinton could have really thought that he didn't have relations with that woman. Maybe he did. Maybe it went to infinite charity to the bad people, I guess.
So I want to try this out on you. And again, I wish we had our one Republican listener, you know, Uncle Clarence.
Well, we've got an Uncle Clarence. We have.
Here to answer this question, though. Right. But I kind of think it's worth asking the question of witnesses during the trial in the Senate, which, by the way, breaking news today, Nancy Pelosi has instructed the impeachment committees to prepare articles of impeachment. So that will be going forward. We will have a trial in the Senate. And I kind of want to ask those witnesses when they make, because the Senate Republicans will ensure that, you know, Tim Morrison is called, that people who are still favorable to the president will testify as to, you know, perceived ambiguities. And I really want to ask them, do you honestly, obviously I want to ask Gordon Sondland this, but do you honestly believe that the president had the best interests of the country at heart when he made this request, when he said, hey, you're going to have to do us a favor first before we release your aid? You honestly believe that was intended to benefit the United States?
Well, we already had Sondland who said, nah, somebody asked, who is this benefit? Who does this benefit? And he said, imagine it benefits Trump.
Yeah, that was Sean Patrick Maloney from New York who expertly cross-examined Sondland. That was the Mr. Sondland, I respect your candor, but I also know exactly what it took to get that out of you.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And look, again, maybe I'm being naive, but I think in a public impeachment with the public watching the actual testimony coming out of the words of the mouths of these individuals, unfiltered by, you know, it's the same testimony, whether you watch it on Fox or whether you watch it on MSNBC.
Yeah.
I honestly believe watching somebody say, no, I definitely think when he said that you had to make a public announcement on CNN that we were investigating Joe Biden, that they were doing that for the good of the country. And if somebody wants to believe that, well, you know, God bless them. But hard for me to see that there's anything there. There is. If I get one last kind of kick before we leave the segment.
It's your wild card segment that we don't have.
Yeah,
time
well,
for,
we're gonna lose the wild card segment again. But on page 45 in discussing why there are no valid campaign finance charges against the president, which, by the way, that is a slam dunk, right? It probably won't be part of articles of impeachment because it will seem like it's...
I love that. You know, there are so many obvious provable crimes. Yeah. That we're actually having the problem of, like, all right, which thing should we put in the official list of things we're impeaching this president for? Well, there's an abundance of them, but I'm sorry. This has been a frustrating, time.
It has been.
And
but,
it's just
know,
like we... the idea that there's all this, we're going to all this trouble. We're bringing these academics, three of whom are respectable and deserve to be there. And they're saying what we all know, and we have so many crimes that we can impeach. We know it all. And then it's going to get to the Senate and nothing's going to happen. And it's very disappointing. And it makes me wonder what's the point of all this, but we got to do it because, it's the Constitution says we should do it. So
here's what Turley says about campaign finance violation. She says, well, you know, it definitely looks like this was something that would benefit the president. Quote, however, the Justice Department already reviewed the call and correctly concluded it was not a federal election violation. Mm. This determination was made by the prosecutors who make the decisions on whether to bring such cases. The Justice Department concluded that the call did not involve a request for a thing of value under federal law. Congress would be alleging a crime that had been declared not to be a crime by career prosecutors. I mean, you hear me giggling through that, but like the idea that Bill Barr, Trump's loyalist, who omitted the word not in multiple instances from his summary of the Mueller report, objectively concluded that his boss did not commit election fraud. It requires a level of naivete that I don't have. So apparently Jonathan Turley does. So we could go on. There's lots more. But there you go. That was the Republicans' witness on why there is legal insufficiency for impeaching the president.
I really, really dislike this guy. I don't know if you caught that, but like...
I did manage to catch that.
I almost would rather he be a right-wing hack. At least then you could say, well, here's the key. He thinks we're murdering 100 million babies a year in abortion, and that trumps everything else, and so he's going to keep the right-wing guy in power because that's what he believes, and he's trying to save the babies. At least you could say that. But this is just, if this guy truly is liberal, this is just a public, laundering of the word, the most corrupt president in history for the sake of getting to say stuff on TV and seeming like you're a cool, smart guy. It drives me nuts.
I can see that. I will tell you, in annotating his 53-page opening statement, I found myself writing, "Hey, is OK Boomer still a thing?" Because that seemed so. But
yes.
There you go.
Yes, it is. All right.
Well, if it is, you will find yourself cutting and pasting that meme into his testimony, which, again, we're linked in the show notes. Don't take our word for it, Uncle Clarence. Go read it yourself.
All right. Well, it is time for happier things, which is First Timer Friday at patreon.com/law. We're going to thank our new patrons who made the plunge, joined up, enjoying bonus stuff, Q&A questions, all that stuff. Why don't you start us off, Andrew?
Okay, Thomas. Thank you to James Rogers, Taryn Iyer, Claudia Gomez, Jason Adome, Peter Vallebo. The first thing we do, let's hail all the lawyers. Oh, nice. And J.D. Wallace.
All right, and thank you to
Thomas.
M.S., Kevin Lowry, Jacob, Jose Pena, Gerald Moore, David Stuver, Donnie Hall, and Charles Colt. Thank you, folks, so much for pledging. Hope you enjoy all the goodies. And now it's time for T3BE, Thomas Takes the Bar exam. Pretty sure I'm on one of those second chance doing well, second chance 100%, but not getting that actual choice of streaks. But we'll see how today goes.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Okay, Thomas. A plaintiff sued a defendant in federal court for injuries arising out of an accident involving the parties. The plaintiff alleged and presented evidence at trial demonstrating that her injuries had left her legs permanently paralyzed. The jury found in favor of the plaintiff and awarded her $5 million in damages. So she's ahead of Devin Nunes. 2 months after the court entered judgment, the defendant was given a videotape made that day showing the plaintiff jogging with her doctor.
With her
doctor. this is a great question.
Yeah.
What is the best way for the defendant to seek relief from the judgment?
I love this question. This feels like it's testing something that we've never tested on any bar question.
I think that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, don't give me any hints. But
move for a new trial or in the alternative for remittor to reduce the award in light of the shortened duration of the plaintiff's injuries.
Mm-hmm.
B, move for relief from the judgment on the ground that the judgment was based on the jury's mistaken belief that the plaintiff's injuries would be permanent.
Mm-hmm.
C, move for relief from the judgment on the ground that the plaintiff committed a fraud in obtaining damages for permanent injuries.
Yikes.
Or D, move for relief from the judgment on the ground that there is newly discovered evidence that the plaintiff.
Okay, I love that. This is such a different question than we've gotten in the past. I love it. So, yeah, I'm really glad that none of the answers were you can't. You can't do it, because that would have made it a lot harder. I mean, it's still hard because they're all very similar answers. But I was wondering if this is going to be the kind of thing where it's like, nope, sorry. Once it's done, it's done. It's like, you know, if the jury.
Jared Kushner gets to be White House chief of staff. There's nothing he can do about it.
Exactly. And I know that sometimes we've talked about what goes on in jury deliberations and how that's kind of a black box. And there's not a whole lot you can do to change that. So I was wondering if it was going to go along those lines. But it sounds like no, because we've got several answers that are all ways that the defendant can get relief. Let's go through them. A, move for a new trial, or in the alternative for remittiture to reduce the award
remittor.
In light. What?
Remittor.
Okay, but you skip a full four letters if you pronounce it that way. Three letters. Remittiture. Just for the record, let the record state that the word is remittiture, and Andrew is saying remitter or something like that. Okay, cool. You can move for a new trial in the alternative or for Worcestershire sauce to reduce the award in light of the shortened duration of the plaintiff's injury. So that would be a new trial is answer A, with some Worcestershire sauce on it. And B, move for relief from judgment on the ground that the judgment was based on the jury's mistaken belief that the plaintiff's injuries would be permanent. I mean, that's kind of like a plain language way of just saying what's happening, which it's sometimes that's the right answer. I don't know, though. I'm not totally sure. This is tough. I don't know that there are any easily eliminable, which Andrew will say is a libel.
Remitter.
Yeah. answers. C, move for relief from the judgment on the ground that the plaintiff committed a fraud in obtaining damages for permanent injuries. That's interesting. So that seems a little more. I'm going to go ahead and eliminate that one. And it could be, I could see a universe in which that's the best way. Because the question is, what is the best way? Oh, geez. Now I'm going to talk myself out of it. And it might be. Now, the last question was super tricky because it was based on, like, well, in some jurisdictions, you know, this would be the best way to do this. And maybe, like, we could live in a world, and this is possible, maybe the law is such that, like, you can't really do anything about this unless someone committed fraud or something. And then that's the only way in which you'd be able to appeal this and change it or something. In which case, C would be a great answer. So never mind. I'm eliminating that. And I don't know. This is an impossible question. D, move for relief from the judgment on the ground that there is newly discovered evidence that the plaintiff's injuries were not permanent. Now, this is interesting. I really like D for the newly discovered evidence part, because that in every crime show, podcasty, whatever, that's always one of the ways you try to do appeals. You know, in Serial, in Making a Murder, it's always like, well, one of the ways you can go is newly discovered evidence. So I really like D for that reason. This is a really hard question for me. The only thing is, I wonder, the fact that the evidence is more about the amount of damages, you know, than it is about what happened. Because if all the facts are the same, and this evidence just says that, like, okay, well, maybe they shouldn't have gotten as much money because they're not disabled forever and they're able to walk again or whatever, that makes me wonder about it, because I don't know, but I don't know enough to know whether that's going to factor in. So, this is tough. I really like newly discovered evidence because I feel like that's a thing constantly in appeals. This is impossible. I don't even think I can eliminate a single answer convincingly in my mind. I mean, maybe C. The reason I was going to eliminate C is I was thinking, well, it could be entirely possible that the plaintiff didn't know that their leg injuries would heal. You know, like, maybe they just, it was a miracle. Angels did it. I don't know. So that's why I went through that of, like, maybe it wasn't fraud. But then will the question be saying, doesn't matter, that's still the best way to seek relief. So I don't know, Andrew. I do know this is, I can't even eliminate a single answer. So I quit.
Wow.
Should I get a four-sided coin? Also known as
also known as two coins.
Yeah. Then I have to come up with a matrix of what each combination is. Movers remissiture to reduce the award. Move for a new trial, or in the alternative, for remission. That's interesting. I could see that. We've talked about the alternative where you kind of do two possibilities, like either let's do a new trial or some sort of remissiture to reduce the award. You know, gosh, that's kind of jumping out at me now. I like that. B, move for relief from the judgment on the ground the judgment was based on the jury's mistaken belief. Sounds super plausible, but, like, that seems like another way of saying I disagree with the jury, sort of. So I could see that not being a good answer. Say, apologies, everybody. This is impossible. I'm sure everybody's just skipping. That's fine. Move for relief from the judgment on the ground that committed fraud. Maybe I'll go with my first instinct and eliminate that one. And then there's newly discovered evidence. Okay, let's go. Not permanent. For some reason, I like the fact that A is the only one that does two things. It's like, either give us a new trial, or in the alternative, go ahead and reduce the award because of, in light of the shortened duration. I don't know if that there's just any basis in reality for this, but I like that better because it just feels like a best way to seek relief. So I'm going to go with A for that reason. I have zero confidence in this. This is one of the hardest questions I've ever had. Can't wait to hear Andrew break it down on Tuesday's episode. Cliffhanger, everybody. A is my final answer.
All right. And if you want to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include your answer, your reasons, therefore, and the hashtag T3BE. And we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Thanks so much for playing along. And most of all, to our patrons, patreon.com/law, who make the show happen. I think we're already coming up, maybe in a week or a little more, on another Lot Awful movies, Andrew. It's so much fun. So jump on Patreon.
A Lot Awful Christmas movie, maybe?
Ooh, that's a great idea. We've done that before, and it was a lot of fun. All right. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we will see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.